And we are rolling. You're ready to go.
Great. Well, welcome. My name is Chuck Anders. I'm the facilitator for the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel. And I want to welcome all of the participants to tonight's meeting. And I would like to turn it over to Miriam Shaw, one of our panel members, to kick things off. So go ahead, Miriam.
Good evening, everyone. And welcome to the 20th meeting of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel. So including all of our workshops and meetings, this is the 20th opportunity for all of us to learn and for you, the public, to participate on this very crucial decommissioning process. In the vein of public participation, the panel has decided that hearing more from the public is a top priority. We decided we want to hear from meeting attendees on each of the topics at hand, and that we also want to hear from you before the end of the meeting, as we've done in the past, because nobody's as fresh at 9 p.m. and able to share. As such, we'll be introducing a new form of public comment tonight. Our method will more closely mirror the methods used at other public meetings that you may attend. We will open the meeting with a time for general public comment on items that are not on tonight's agenda. Then, after each topic is discussed tonight, there will be time to comment on each of the specific topics presented. If you ask a question during public comment, I will do my best to record it with PG&E staff backing me up. At the end of each public comment period, after everyone has spoken, I will read all the questions back to our staff. They will do the best to answer, or they have the email addresses of all registered participants tonight, and they may need to send you an answer later. Please keep in mind that our PG&E staff can only respond to topics that are relevant to the decommissioning here at Diablo Canyon, so there may be questions that they simply cannot answer. If so, they will let you know that. After questions, members of our panel may also want to discuss public comments, and we will also have time for that. We're really hoping this gives people more opportunity for constructive participation, so please bear with us as we try something new. So without further ado, let me introduce our meeting. You'll see on our agenda that there are two main topics. First, we will hear about the pending project application and receive an update on the CEQA process. We will also hear about some additional opportunities coming up for the public to participate in this county process by Zoom. After public comment on that topic, we will review recommendations for updates to the DCDEP strategic vision document and the process that's associated with making those updates. We are hoping that it will be an informative and more interactive meeting than ever before. And so with that, let me turn things over to Dr. Tim Oren for a safety update tonight.
Thank you very much, Miriam. We'll be short. Right along with birds, today's safety minute is going to regard good communication. Respect and good communication go hand in hand. Respectful discussions on areas of conflict that are not only charged with little understanding, change is unlikely to occur. Disrespectful comments can result in people closing their minds to new ideas and can lead to polarization within groups. In the industrial setting, this leads to people having an "it's not my job" attitude towards safety. This attitude can stem from a desire to avoid future conflict or simply stem from dislike of the individual who may be affected by the safety culture. Workers and people in general feel more relaxed and are arguably more productive in environments where communication is respectful. A work environment with open communication avoids many distractions of interpersonal conflict, promotes a safe work environment, and allows work to proceed with focus on the job at hand. Chuck?
Great, thank you. Thank you, Tim. I want to remind everyone that this is a webinar format and that all the presentations and the video of this meeting can be seen on the panel's website at DiabloCanyonPanel.org. And so after the meeting, you can check there and you can see copies of the presentations and other resource materials, including the agenda. The public can also submit written comments anytime they want by going to the website, DiabloCanyonPanel.org, and clicking on the submit comment button. And that becomes part of the public record also. So the next item on our agenda, I would like to introduce Maureen, who's a member of our panel, to give us a PG&E update. Maureen Zawala.
Thank you, Chuck, and thank you, panel from the public. I first want to start with the sound check. Tom Jones, can you hear me okay?
You're just fine. There's a clicking noise, so if AGP can try to filter that out, we've got some.
Yeah, there's some clicking
noise. Yeah, I think this is Chuck's audio. So if Chuck can deal with that, I can't do anything from it this end, but if he mutes himself, it's okay.
Thank you.
Okay, great. I just want to check on that. Okay, good evening, everyone. I really appreciate the opportunity to provide some key updates on the Diablo Canyon Power Plant decommissioning project. There's lots going on and lots to share, and really appreciate the continued collaboration with the engagement panel and the public. So I want to first provide an update as part of our commitment to keep you updated regarding plans for how we will decommission Diablo Canyon Power Plant. I want to make you aware of that after, you know, comprehensive evaluations and analysis and benchmarking and all of the collaborative discussions with key stakeholders, including the panel, PG&E will be submitting the hybrid approach as our recommendation in our December nuclear decommissioning cost triennial proceedings filing to the CPUC, the California Public Utility Commission. We've discussed in previous meetings that there are essentially five strategies in the United States that we evaluated. They include self-perform or self-manage, decommissioning general contractor, hybrid, what we're really putting forth to the CPUC, license stewardship, and the license transfer asset sale. So those are the five strategies. And again, we'll be putting forth in our filing the recommendation to CPUC to use the hybrid approach. The hybrid approach, you know, allows PG&E to remain stewards and owners, you know, of the project and retain our employees in key areas that we have strong core competencies, while using vendors and contractors in other areas that we don't have those skill sets, perhaps things like reactor vessel segmentation. PG&E's using insights and experience that we've also gained from the safe and successful decommissioning at Humble Bay Power Plant, where we did also use the hybrid approach. And we're very, you know, very much value the feedback and the meaningful engagement with this panel and the strategic vision input that we've received, you know, to date, and as well as input also from labor unions and other key stakeholders. So really just wanted to highlight that as a key update. We have a lot going on, a lot of things over the next several months. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tom Jones to add anything more on the Diablo Canyon decommissioning project update.
Thanks, Maureen. I think we'll hear a lot of the coming attractions tonight from Trevor, Keith, and Susan Strachan on the county environmental process. Outside of that, we also expect to have an update from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission sometime soon for something called the PSDAR, and that's the Post-Shutdown Decommissioning Activities Report. It's the NRC's version of the environmental process that the county is leading for the state and local governments. It's required by regulation as well, and it requires a meeting to be held in the host reactor community. So that was suspended during COVID. We heard an update from that branch of the NRC today at a conference, and they intend to do a hybrid model as well, not to confuse it with the contracting strategy, but both an in-person meeting and an online meeting. They just recently did that at Duane Arnold, which is another plant power plant headed for decommissioning, and they intend to hold it, and the county will host them at the County Government Center in San Luis Obispo. The date has yet to be scheduled, so So I don't want the public to be confused. There will be 6 environmental meetings likely in the next 90 days for Diablo Canyon, 5 of which the county will lead for the CEQA process for the California Environmental Quality Act, and 1 for potentially 2 from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then lastly, an update for the panel, and maybe some members of the public might know, our director of decommissioning, Eric Nelson, had been with the company for 30 years. Eric was really helped fashion the 28 NDTCP, our budget. He brought together many of the engineering scope and things that led to the cost analysis. He is retired and he's still living in Los Osos, and we'll have a new a new project team member to introduce you to, Craig Murray, who's taken over that position. So that's a big leadership change for us. Craig comes to us with over 30 years of nuclear experience and extensive project management. I'm very familiar with Diablo Canyon. I've been there about 10 years. So those are the updates. And Maureen and I'd be happy to take any questions the panel might have. Chuck, I see you talking. It appears you're on mute, and Kara has a hand up, and then Bill Balmes does. Kara, why don't you go ahead, because I can't hear Chuck.
Okay, thank you. Maureen and Tom, I had a question about this hybrid contracting strategy you mentioned. We've had many discussions over our last public hearings about project labor agreements and making sure that decommissioning activities really favor local jobs. And I'm wondering, if we go to a hybrid contracting strategy, does that still hold true? So, for example, if PG&E enters into some kind of agreement to secure local jobs, does that mean your subcontractors or contractors or other consultants are tied to that? Or does that change that dynamic?
It's the most flexible and the most advantageous based on that feedback. So I will say it this way. All labor strategies, employment strategies will cascade from that. Now, we're introducing this into the 2021 NDTCP, and some parties might argue it's not the most efficient. We think it's the most effective, and it's a model very similar to what they use in San Onofre and what we were successful in decommissioning Humble Bay with. So the short answer is yes, it puts PG&E in the driver's seat for the employment. Essentially, we function as the general contractor, and then we hire subs to do those scopes of work that we don't have in-house.
Tom, so I'll ask my question. The NRC meeting is the quote hybrid meeting. Is that going to be specific to Title 50, their portion of the decommissioning, right?
Correct. It'll be, and it looks under NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act. It looks at environmental consequences in that rubric. And the NRC has done a generic EIS, an environmental impact statement, similar to the EIR, Environmental Impact Report in California. And then since they've done that for all decommissioning activities at a nuclear power plant, you then fall in under different categories of that pre-existing analysis. So the NRC will run that meeting. So it's similar, but a different regulatory driver.
Different driver, and they won't cover a lot of the same topics. I mean, outbuildings, for example, that aren't involved would not be part of this.
They'll discuss anything in the Part 50 license. So that's that 751-acre area. What they won't examine is repurposing the same way that the county will, for instance. They'll look at, if we're going to repurpose a building, has that location been deemed clear of any radiological contamination? Is it fit for unrestricted use? It'll look at different impacts. They're not going to get, and they don't get into traffic the same way that the state does. They look at traffic, but not entirely the same way. So the methodologies aren't consistent between the two. So think of it like a two-circle Venn diagram of environmental regulation with some overlap and some not.
Okay, thank you.
Chuck, is your audio back?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I think I got it.
It's still clicking, Chuck.
Still clicking.
Chuck, why don't we work on your clicking and mute, and I'll take the questions here. So, Kara, your hand's still up. I don't know if that's for another question, but in order, I had Scott, then Linda, then David. So, Scott?
Yes. Just for clarification, Tom, I know you said that you would be acting as the general. So in reference to the whole decommissioning, there's not a general contractor, and all the other contractors would be prime contractors that PG&E will sign agreements with. Is that correct?
Most likely. We would have the option to still hire, for instance, a professional project management firm if we wanted to hand that scope out.
More construction management then versus the general.
Right.
So there won't be a third party general contractor. It will be a construction management with prime contracts signed directly with PG&E.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Now, some of those might have a sub still, right? We still might have two or three deep on the contract.
Yeah. Yes, I understand that.
So, Scott, to your point, it's, you know, discrete scopes.
Yes.
Or the other.
Yes.
All right. You get it? All right, Scott and Linda, you got any questions?
Yeah, I have a question about the contracts for the hybrid model. Will those contracts be for the length of the project? Like, can we be assured that PG&E will stay in the driver's seat for the length of the contract? Like, it will be sold?
Well, those are different questions. So what we pose in the rate case for validation from the CPUC is this model. That has to go through the rate case still. So others could argue PG&E might not be as efficient. Some from a cost perspective might want someone else to do it. Others might want that point of view that you just articulated for us to stay. So I can't give you 100% certainty on your question. That's our intention, and that's what we are filing.
Okay, thank you.
David. Am I up? Okay. Hi, Tom. Thanks. So kind of sort of, I guess, an add-on to a little bit of what Kara and I think Miriam kind of mentioned. So I don't have it in front of me, but I know there was public testimony we got on a local hire project labor agreement, or I can't remember the terminology exactly that was used. Would it be accurate to characterize what PG&E is going to propose as similar to the setup you have right now for maintenance? Right now, PG&E has their own forces there that perform a lot of the work, maintenance work and otherwise. You also have general contractors there that perform maintenance work and otherwise. Is that a similar setup like decommissioning will you envision your proposal?
It'll be similar, but it won't be the same, David. So, you know, we still will have core competencies. I think Maureen introduced it this way. Core competencies that PG&E has on staff today. The part of our goal is to retain those employees because of their familiarity with the site. We think there's great efficiency in skilled, knowledgeable employees, right? For scopes outside of that work, we do not, we'll obviously contract that out. We're not going to create craft for us when there are craft around the United States and locally that do this far better than us, right? So think laborers, think demolition, things that we don't have on site right now. I would see that as scope that we would contract out. Now, we've got a ways to go. Yeah, we're still running the place for 4 more years, and we've got this filing for about 18 months. So those contract scopes will get further refined. I would also just remind folks of the process. When we go into that contract space, we'll do requests for proposals to solicit participants to help us with the project. They might have different bid strategies and different demolition strategies. So we'll learn a lot when we do the RFP as well, right? People that do the scope that we're not as familiar with will have different approaches than we might think. So it'll be dynamic, but I don't expect it to be radically different from how we manage today. I don't know if Maureen, you have anything to add to that.
Just one thing I wanted to add, David, is in our request for information last summer on the contracting strategy out to the industry, we emphasized the importance of leveraging and using local labor. And in our recent discrete scopes of requests for proposals on things such as our cold and dark strategies and component removals and so forth. We make sure that that's in the language as well. So we continue as PG&E to always emphasize using the local labor.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to make sure that it doesn't get lost in a, you know, obviously complex scenario here, but we had strong testimony from local labor representatives and local labor workers about the importance of an agreement that that makes sure that we do have local labor and apprentices that are given the opportunity to work on this project.
Yeah, David, that was a significant consideration in this decision, and this gives us the greatest flexibility to gain that goal.
Thank you.
We're not hearing you, Chuck.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for the technical difficulties on my end. Any further questions of Tom or Maureen? All right, the next item on our agenda is general public comment. So I would ask any of the public attendees if you would like to speak on this topic now, other than the topics on our agenda, which is the project application and the panel strategic vision document. Anyone else? I have two people. I have Eric Greening and Jack Krasner. And Jeff Wheelwright. Okay, Eric Greening, go ahead. 3 minutes, please.
Jack, you're going to have to mute and unmute. You keep clicking.
Okay, good. I'm. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. This is Eric Greening. Thank you for that presentation. I'm going to have more comments relative to the county process and the EIR process, but my comment right now is simply a suggestion for a future meeting topic and presenters for it, and that would be to invite someone from one or both of the utilities active with the San Onofre decommissioning, and then sort of for another view from a different angle of that process, invite someone from the Samuel Lawrence Foundation and get a feeling and learn what we can from the experience of a utility that is several years ahead of us on a track that is at least parallel to and may have some resemblance to the track that we're going to be on here. And hopefully we can learn from missteps as well as successes. And so, again, I would say don't do it without having the balance. In other words, have someone from one or the other of the utilities involved and have someone from the Samuel Lawrence Foundation so that we get a range of points of view on the experience and lessons to be learned there. And I'm thankful for the opportunity to engage on agenda items as they go along. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next commenter is Jack Krasner, followed by Ben Brown.
And Miriam, when it's time, we have an update about the San Onofre lessons learned when you're ready.
Hi there, everybody on the panel. Thank you for this opportunity. I live in Pismo Beach, and my questions are going to be focused on the Pismo Beach rail yard and rail transfer construction. In a recent notice in one of the local papers, it indicates there are three additional locations for potential rail transfer sites, one of which is the Pismo Beach Materials Handling Facility on Price Canyon Road. Has that facility gone through CEQA and the EIR requirements to be approved? That's one question. I do see that a company in San Luis Obispo, by the name of Precision Estimating Services, has already built out a 20,000 square foot hazardous waste transfer building, installed 3,100 feet of new track, and done some significant upgrades on roadways and traffic signals. This facility is very close to a middle school and also quite close to residential properties. So I am alarmed by the location and the potential for problems, and want to know what has been done to mitigate such problems as they could come up. Thank you.
So Chuck, you're on mute. Mr. Krasner, so this is general public comment. We are going to address the environmental impact report, including the scoping meetings, and the experts from the County of San Luis Obispo Planning Department here tonight.
Okay.
Address that question at that time. So we'll have additional public comment at that period.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next commenter is Ben Brown. Ben, go ahead.
Good evening, panel. My name is Ben Brown, San Luis Obispo. I had a comment and a related question. My comment is, I'm very concerned about the removal of this large amount of baseload clean power that's local to our area, especially in light of the COP26 conference that's going on right now as we all race to reduce carbon emissions in our grids. My question was, what are the plans by PG&E to provide a similar level of clean baseload power for the Central Coast after the removal of the Diablo Canyon asset? Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. With that, I don't have any more questions or presenters. No more hands raised. So let's go on to the discussion. Mariam, do you want to lead the discussion on the questions, please?
Yeah, I'll just kind of go through a couple of the questions. It seems that if I was hearing you correctly, Tom, that both of Jack Krasner's questions should hopefully be answered down the line during the presentations.
That's correct. It's an appropriate time for that question. It was just out of sequence in terms of the public comment.
Okay.
I know Susan and Trevor are listening. I'm sure they'll incorporate that. And I know in Susan's overview, she'll mention all three rail sites. And I believe there's some imagery to help with that.
Okay, that sounds great. And please, Mr. Krasner, ask again if you feel you want some follow-up. And then I think the only other question I got was from Mr. Brown. What are plans by PG&E to provide clean baseload power after the decommissioning? And I know that's a broad question, but give us your best. Thank you.
Sure. So what's happening is we had the joint proposal in 2016 to close Diablo Canyon Power Plant to ensure an orderly transition from Diablo Canyon. There are three main drivers why Diablo Canyon is going offline from an energy consumption and deliverability standpoint. The first is community choice aggregation. When customers leave community choice aggregation, PG&E no longer provides that power. So if you think of a large pie chart, our diameter keeps shrinking more and more, and the Central Coast is starting to go towards community choice aggregation as well. So the power generation is no longer PG&E's responsibility to serve those customers. The transmission and deliverability is. So those community choice aggregators, they're out in the marketplace securing that power now. So it's much broader than just a Pacific Gas and Electric company. It's a California-wide state public policy issue. So with that, this California legislature and Governor Brown enacted Senate Bill 1090, and it actually ordered that Diablo Canyon be replaced by the regulators, both the Public Utilities Commission and the CAISO, that's the independent system operator, that they sought to have carbon-free replacement for Diablo Canyon. And with that all going on, and Chuck, if you could mute again, the net effect is that the demand still continues to decrease, but our peaks are shifting. So the biggest challenge for the state with these different shifting issues and Diablo Canyon coming offline is 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. And that has to do with something called the duck chart. So what we'll do, Miriam, is we'll provide an answer to that to put on the panel and PG&E's website that we refer to the joint proposal and the changing energy landscape in California. It's not a simple one answer question. It's a very dynamic challenge that the state's going to face when Diablo Canyon comes offline. But it's also much broader than just a PG&E answer to that challenge. We are required to not only provide for our customers, but we're the provider of last resort. So if somebody else fails in delivering power, then it's up to us, to Southern California Edison, and up to San Diego Gas and Electric to go out and get that power. But we'll provide an answer to that. We have it on our site as well, on our larger PG&E site, but we'll bring that over to the decommissioning panel to address that question for this question and those.
All right, thank you. And those were all the questions I recorded. I know there was a suggestion about songs, and I don't know if you want to share, you know, that we do look at other power plants as a commission.
You bet, Miriam. So what we do is we look at benchmarking across. There are 36 sites that are going through decommissioning in the United States. 10 have graduated. I think of them as alumni status. They've successfully remediated the site and retired their Part 50 license. We expect Humboldt Bay, that PG&E had owned and operated and decommissioned, to be the 11th this year. So within the next 6 to 8 weeks, we expect to retire that license. We are also benchmarking regularly on San Onofre. We have regular operational meetings with them, and some of their employees are former Diablo Canyon employees. And then lastly, between PG&E and the panel, there's a memorandum of understanding, and that includes the ability to benchmark. And so the panel is traveling down to San Onofre on the 16th and 17th of November, and Southern California Edison and their partner owners are going to host the Diablo Canyon engagement panel for about a 6-hour briefing and walkthrough of the site. And it's a very active, dynamic site right now. So it's the perfect time to really season the panel with what we're going to be looking at 7 to 10 years from now. I do want to remind folks of the timeline, right? We're operating for 4 more years still, and then you don't get into really meaningful decommissioning until you transfer the fuel from the spent fuel pool. And that on current schedule is 2029. So when you really start to think 9 years from now, 2029, 2030 is when we'll be looking at containment demolition, you know, remediation and demolition. So we're still a ways out. And Edison has been fantastic to us with sharing information and resources. And we've tried to reciprocate with our lessons learned at Humboldt. So it's really nice. And again, the panel will be down there in the next 2 weeks to see with their own eyes.
Hey, Tom, I would also add that we're very involved, PG&E, in the decommissioning project, you, Tom Jones, and Craig Murray, as you mentioned, in the team, in industry working groups, the Nuclear Energy Institute, the Decommissioning Plant Coalition. So getting a lot of benchmarking and industry input in those venues as well.
Thank you. I think at this point, I had planned to turn it over to Chuck to kind of moderate now the comments of the panelists. Chuck, I don't know if you're having audio issues, if you want me to do that, or do you want to jump in and do that? Because I see Kara has a comment.
I'm hopeful that I got it fixed. So does this sound a little better?
It does sound better. So you go for it. Thank you.
All right. My apologies for the distractions before.
You're muted.
I'm sorry. I apologize for my prior distractions. Does this sound okay?
Good. Great job.
All right, Kara, I saw you had your hand up. Go ahead. You have a comment?
Yeah, just a quick comment to Ben Brown. One of the items that we've discussed a little bit in prior meetings is the opportunity for offshore wind turbines in the Morro Bay Call area. And those, under a rosy scenario, if everything goes as planned, could be online as soon as 2029 or 2030, which coincides with what Tom just said about the timeline for Diablo decommissioning. And that's expected to bring online 3 gigawatts. Which is as much as Diablo generated at 2.2 plus what was lost when the Morro Bay power plant shut down. So there is an opportunity that's, you know, beginning to come online, you know, a lot to do between now and then, but there are some alternatives definitely being considered.
Great. Thank you, Kara. Any other comments before we move on to our next agenda item? Thank you to members of the public who provided those comments. Our next agenda item is a discussion of the project application and CEQA process, and we're fortunate to have one of our panel members, Trevor Keith, who is going to kick this topic off, and Trevor is also an ex officio member of the panel. So, Trevor, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chuck, and thank you, panel, for having us back. We've made a lot of progress with PG&E on the application and getting it to a point where we've got some more dates on the calendar. So with me tonight, I have Susan, who is our decommissioning manager here at the County of San Luis Obispo. And I'll turn it over for her to kind of go through where we are in the application process and kind of next steps with some public engagement on the scoping meetings. And then we're happy to take questions from the panel. So thank you, Chuck, again, and panel members for having us back. And I will turn it over to Susan.
Thank you. Thanks, Trevor. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate the opportunity. I think I was before you in May giving an update on where things were with regard to the process. And so we have made a lot of progress since that time, and I'll go into details of where we are. Chuck, if the PowerPoint could get pulled up. Okay, next slide, please. So what I'm going to talk about today is just an overview of the planning process, and then talk about focusing on the CEQA process and the timeline. We've got some public scoping meetings coming up, and I'll focus on the opportunities for public participation throughout the California Environmental Quality Act process. Next slide, please. So to give you an update on where we are from a permitting standpoint, PG&E filed an application with us on March 29th. The application was for for the portion of the site within the coastal zone, a coastal development permit development plan, and then for the portion of the site outside of the coastal zone, a conditional use permit. Once we received the application, the county does a 30-day review of the application to determine whether it has all of the information we need to proceed into the CEQA process. We also send out referral letters to numerous agencies and organizations for their input. So on April 28th, we sent out what's referred to as an information hold letter to PG&E, identifying additional information that we needed in the application. PG&E responded on July 8th with an application supplement, providing information requested. And then also they included some project description changes in that filing. We again had another 30 days to go through that. And on August 9th, and we again did the referrals to the agencies. And on August 9th, sent a second information hold letter to PG&E. We got the responses back to that letter on October 6th and reviewed that, sent referral letters out again. But on October 27th, we accepted the application as complete. Next slide, please. So the big question, where do we go now? But basically the CEQA process begins, and we are going to prepare an environmental impact report for this project. San Luis Obispo County is the lead agency. We have other agencies that have permitting authority over the project. State Lands Commission, for example, Coastal Commission, to the extent on the rail facilities that were mentioned previously, that the permit discretionary permits are required for those local jurisdictions would also serve as responsible agencies. So we have the lead role in preparation of the environmental impact report, but work hand in hand with the other agencies that have permitting authority. Aspen Environmental Group is going to prepare the environmental impact report. What's significant about that is that Aspen prepared the environmental impact report for the San Onofre decommissioning. So to have a consultant who has done an EIR for decommissioning for a nuclear power plant in California is fabulous. We're thrilled to have them on board. As I mentioned, that during this process, we'll coordinate with responsible and also trustee agencies. And again, this is a key part for public participation. Next slide, please. So I briefly want to go through the EIR process. So first step is issuance of the notice of preparation. And the notice of preparation went out on October 28th. And I'll get into details in a little bit about what does that mean, what does that entail. However, one of the pieces of it is holding of scoping meetings. And again, I'm going to get into more detail on what those are about and when we're going to be having them. But a key component is the scoping meetings are the first opportunity for public involvement. And again, I'll talk about that. After scoping, then the draft EIR environmental impact report is prepared. When that comes out, a notice of availability is issued and it starts a public review period. We will do a 60-day review period for that document. And this is an opportunity for people to provide comments on the document. There'll also be a planning commission hearing. No decision will be made. It's an opportunity to provide comments at that hearing. So comments can be submitted via U.S. mail. They can be submitted via email. They could also be done verbally at a planning commission hearing. So again, another opportunity for public involvement. After that is done, then the final environmental impact report is prepared. And that document consists of a response to the comments received on the draft EIR and then any necessary revisions to that document. Once that comes out, then it moves over into the decision making. So the activities are the EIR is certified, findings have to be adopted. There's something referred to as a statement of overriding consideration. If there's a significant impact is overridden, I guess is the best way that that's where that comes in. Project decision happens in that time. And then if the project's approved in a mitigation monitoring program is adopted. So again, this is all done in a public forum and an opportunity for public involvement. If it is approved by the county, then the next step is that the responsible and trustee agencies make their decisions. Next slide. Okay, so now let's talk about the first step in the EIR process. So I mentioned the issuance and the notice of preparation, which happened on October 28th. The purpose of that notice is that it solicits agency, organization, and public input on the EIR scope and content. It includes a project description, or included, I should say, since it's been issued. It identifies the scoping comment period, and it provides the dates of the virtual scoping meetings that we're going to be holding. Next slide. Now, the purpose of scoping is important because it's an opportunity for agencies and the public to talk about what they think should be described or included in the EIR. Specifically, the project alternatives that should be addressed, how things should be evaluated, and then if there's specific mitigation measures. Those are all things that can be brought out as part of the scoping comments during that period. Next slide, please. Now for scoping details, we're in the scoping comment period right now. Now typically scoping is a 30-day period. We've extended it because day 30 fell, I think it was the Friday after Thanksgiving, and we assumed that people would not be too pleased having comments due basically the week of Thanksgiving. So we extended it another week, actually to Monday, December 6th. We're going to hold 5 virtual scoping scoping meetings, and the dates are listed there. We have one coming up on Tuesday, November 9th, 10 a.m. We'll do another one at 6 p.m. that day. We'll have one on December 1st at 10 a.m. and another one at 6 p.m. And then we're going to have one on Saturday, December 4th at 2 p.m. So the idea with the number, I can tell you based on my involvement on projects, I've never done one with that many scoping meetings. But the key to this is to provide as many opportunities as we can for the public and the public's different schedules to help accommodate and give them the opportunity to attend one of these. The details in terms of how to access the scoping meetings, I know that it's on the engagement panel website, and they're also on the county website. And the comments, we'll have the meetings where verbal comments can be provided. But again, comments can be provided via email, and then they can be provided via U.S. mail. And those details are all online in terms of how to do that. Next slide, please. So here's the agenda of what we'll be doing at the scoping meetings. We'll obviously have introductions. The Aspen team will be there. We'll give a project overview of basically the project description for the project. And then we're going to give people an opportunity to ask questions on the project description. Now, this is a county meeting, but it's obviously a very detailed project. So we will have PG&E available to when during the question and answer phase of the meeting. Then we're going to move into, I have the words in here, county-driven analysis regarding future site reuse concepts. This is not part of PG&E's application. This is an analysis that we're going to include, and I'll get into more detail in a bit, looking at what are some potential options for the site post-decommissioning. We'll have that discussion, and then again, get into questions and answers. And then Aspen will give an overview of the EIR process and another opportunity for questions and answers on the EIR process. Once we get through all of that, then we will open it up for scoping comments from attendees at the meetings. Next slide. So this kind of gets into the ideas of, well, what are scoping comments? What are the kinds of things that people could ask? And so some of these suggested areas to comment on are, again, generally the scope and content of the EIR, which should be covered in the EIR. If someone has local environmental knowledge that would be as helpful for the environmental impact report, they can talk about that. Issues that someone feels need evaluation or how the issues should be evaluated, feasible alternatives to the proposed project, and then mitigation measures to avoid or reduce impacts. And then again, as I mentioned on these future site reuse options, what are some ideas that the public may have on those reuse options or concepts? Next slide, Pete, please. So the next steps after scoping is we get to work, Aspen gets to work on preparation of the draft EIR. So one thing to remember is there's then this block of time where, you know, a lot of work is being done in terms of developing the document, but there are not public meetings until that document actually comes out. So as I said, the process will take several months. Once the draft EIR comes out, we will have that public comment period that I mentioned before. And then second, we'll have the final environmental impact report and then public hearings on the certification of the EIR and decision on the project. Next slide. Next slide, please. Thank you. Now, I was not intending to get into a focus on the project description in this presentation, but just generally, in terms of the EIR, it will evaluate PG&E's proposed decommissioning, and it covers the time periods labeled there, phase one from 2024 to 2031, which is the phase where a bulk of the decommissioning activities will happen. And then then phase two, 2032 to 2039, where it's primarily focused on activities are on soil remediation, final site surveys, which are required by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and then final site restoration. Next slide, please. Now, as I mentioned on the future reuse options, in the EIR, it'll be identified as a phase three. So the previous slide talked about phases one and two, which are tied directly to PG&E's decommissioning effort. But this is post that time period. Again, it's a county-driven analysis. It's not part of PG&E's proposed project. But the intent of it is it's going to be included for a high-level analysis of possible uses after decommissioning. So it'll give an indication of what could be some of the potential impacts associated with any of the reuse options that are evaluated in the EIR. If somebody were then to come in and apply to do something on that site, then that would go through its own more detailed CEQA evaluation. Next slide, please. So in terms of public participation opportunities, for information opportunities, the County Planning and Building website is where the application, PG&E's application materials can be found. And we are working on a way to make that, I'm trying to make that a little bit more user-friendly, and we'll be working on that very soon and getting that addressed. You can also sign up on the County Diablo Decommissioning email list. So if you're on the county's webpage over on the for planning and building, on the left hand side, there's a column of I'm forgetting the name, but it's the things that are the most popular that people have the most interest in, and it says Diablo decommissioning. You click on that. If you scroll down at the end of that page for Diablo decommissioning, there's a place to sign up for the email list. So that's an automatic way to get notification of meetings or any activities. And then again, in terms of EIR processing opportunities for involvement, it's scoping, making comments on the scoping, draft EIR comment period in the public hearing, and then certification of the EIR and the project description. Couple things I do want to address is I did not, and I apologize, include schedule information in this presentation. We are we're working on the schedule fast and furiously, just aren't quite yet ready to release that publicly. However, I do anticipate that we'll be doing that at the scoping meeting next week. And then I also want to address the comments with regard to the rail yards. So there's three rail yards that will be evaluated. The one at Pismo, PG&E has stated that it would be used as a contingency, and it would not, there would be no hazardous waste and no radioactive waste would be sent to that site. The other two locations are in Santa Barbara County, one in the city of Santa Maria and one in unincorporated Santa Barbara County. Both of those will be evaluated in the EIR. However, only one of those will be used. Notices were sent out to property owners around each of the all three of those locations. No decision has been made. They have not yet been evaluated. That's the purpose of the EIR. The reason we send the notices now is we want everyone to be aware that we are going to do an EIR and we are going to be evaluating this particular site for that, the rail yard for that use. And so we want the public to be aware of that. So that's why that notice was sent out. And that concludes my presentation, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Sharon.
It's Susan, Chuck.
I am sorry. I apologize.
For some thank reason, you. I get called Sharon a lot, so I probably would have just answered yes.
Thank you, Susan. Now as we have the opportunity for public comment on these topics. And so I would ask any of the public attendees, if you would like to make a public comment or ask a question, now would be the time to do that. And go ahead and raise your hand.
I don't have a hand to raise, but I'm in line. Eric here.
Okay, who is that? Eric, I don't have a raised hand since you brought me in as a panelist, but I'll get in line with whoever's...
Oh, okay, I got you. Okay, first we have Susan Harvey and then Eric Greeny. So, Susan, please ask your question or make your comment.
Can you hear me now? There I go. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. I'm wondering about phase three and scoping comments and the county's analysis of reuse. Does that apply only to parcel P? The EIR is only looking at parcel P, is that correct?
That's correct, it's just parcel P, so the reuse options would be limited to parcel P.
Okay. Would the, nothing in the EIR then would necessarily be looking at what opportunities there are for mitigating impacts with surrounding properties that PG&E owns?
It would look at impacts associated with decommissioning within parcel P. If there were a part of the project that would impact offsite, so for example, the rail site, the rail loading facilities I mentioned, those are offsite, so it will evaluate that. But since the project boundaries are limited to parcel P, that's where the focus is.
And you wouldn't, I guess I didn't state that very well. Okay. Is there a potential for offsite mitigations for onsite impacts?
That's one that's so early to tell. It's hard for me to make an answer on that right now since we're just getting started.
All right, thank you so much.
Susan, I understand your question, but it depends on the impact. It's hard to answer that.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Susan. Eric Greening, please go ahead and also state your name at the beginning and your residence.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening. I live in the North County, and I think the reason people are calling Susan Sharon is because she's sharing so much important information. But anyway, I do have a question that I guess the timeline is still a little bit mysterious on the EIR, but I have a concern to raise about that timeline in reference to something I brought up at the county supervisors yesterday when Susan was giving a progress report, which is that a very important increment of this project is the casks and how they will be handled. And we don't yet know what that will look like. And I was essentially defending the need of the EIR to provide full analysis and mitigation of the hazards thereof, even though the county doesn't have control over that particular increment of the project, for the same reason, for example, that it needs to look at hazards and mitigations of those hazards relative to things like earthquakes, even though it has no control over the placement of faults or the timing or intensity of earthquakes. So in any event, my concern is the consultants were given a budget which presumes a certain workload and a certain timeline. And I would just like to hope that whatever it takes to fully understand the casks and how they will be handled and how they would be handled in the event of a need to replace one, et cetera, so that mitigation measures could be developed as needed once the hazards are fully understood, that we not rush this thing ahead of a full understanding thereof. And then the only other thing, and I'm going to bring these up during scoping too, this morning, I was at a very sobering global meeting relative to Fukushima and the plan to hemorrhage. 860 trillion becquerels worth of radioactive water into the Pacific. I can see a nexus for careful monitoring, not only relative to Fukushima as a kind of a nexus for hazards we endure here generated locally, but also perhaps to catch local anything that locally gets into the ocean. Currently, the Mothers for Peace sample ocean water and send it to Woods Hole, and it has detected spikes from Fukushima of cesium. But what we do not have, and apparently don't have anywhere along the coast of the U.S., is monitoring up the food chain. Concentrations in the seawater are one thing, but concentration in sea life, especially as you get toward the upper end of the food chain pyramid, can be quite a bioconcentrated other thing. And so I would just like to put out there the possibility that we look at a program, and presumably the different isotopes we could identify what might come from a Diablo decommissioning operation versus what might have come from Fukushima. But we definitely need to be gathering information about both. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric. Any other public attendees that would like to make a comment on this issue, on the project application? All right, we have one panelist hand up, and that's Patrick Lemieux.
Hi, thank you. I'm Patrick Lemieux. I'm a panelist on the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel. And I have two questions for you, Susan. One is, I'm still a little unclear on the timeline of the county-driven analysis and future site reuse. You mentioned that phase three starts in 2039, and I'm unclear. Is that when a final decision is made on the reuse of parcel P, or is that when work is actually starting?
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I apologize for being unclear with that. It's the time frame when a reuse option could occur. So it'll be part of the EIR, just like, and included in the EIR for the project. That's when the analysis will be done. But the phase three is meant to show the phase in time. So you have phases one and two where the actual decommissioning activities will occur. Phase three, site reuse, it's just what we're referring to it as, would be after the site it has been released by the NRC.
So we're ready to build in 2039.
That's the concept of that.
Okay. The other thing that I'm unclear about, that seems to fall into the practice in my mind with respect to the EIR, and since there's been already a fair bit of discussion about railway impact and mitigation, is the alternative to that would be barging. And my understanding is that is, while for a very long time that was not an option, this is now back on the table as a likely means of moving or participating in the decommissioning of Diablo Canyon, and obviously relieving a lot of the railway congestion that would otherwise occur. Is that an important part of the IR that the county is doing? Are we still considering this as a likely method of removing stuff from the decommissioning?
So it is. PG&E's proposal is a blended approach to transportation, which includes barging. And the significance of the barging is that you can transport a lot more waste on a barge than you can in a truck. So it does dramatically reduce the number of trucks on the road compared to if everything was being trucked out. So there is a portion of barging. There is direct truck, meaning truck from the site to a disposal facility. And then the third is truck to rail. So trucking from the site to one of those rail yards that I had mentioned. But that is the proposal, and that's what will be evaluated in the EIR.
Great, thank you. Before we get into too much more discussion, I don't know, I don't see Patrick now. I don't know if he disappeared.
He's still here.
Okay, good. There you go. Miriam, did we have any questions from the public that you felt weren't answered or we needed to follow up on?
I think that Susan Harvey's questions were answered in real time. And it sounds like, Susan, please correct me if I'm wrong, that if she attends one of the scoping meetings, that maybe these things can be fleshed out more. Would that be fair?
I think she's asking a very good question. It's just a question that at this point in time, I don't have an answer because we haven't done the analysis, so we don't know what the impacts are. So without knowing what the impacts are, I can't get into detail of what the mitigation could be. So answer a question like that.
Okay, and Eric Greening was asking about cask safety, and I did want to point out that dry storage is going to be on our next agenda, but I don't know if you wanted to comment, is cask safety going to be part of the EIR process?
There's a preemption issue when it deals with radiation hazards and nuclear safety. The state and local governments are preempted by the NRC. That is in the NRC's purview. So, and then secondly, the dry cask storage area, the independent fed fuel storage installation, has already been permitted. So the location and the ability to its size to accommodate the waste from the decommissioning effort. The cask design that PG&E is now looking at is under the purview of the NRC. And Tom, I don't know, your hand was up. I didn't know if you wanted to add to that.
I think you hit it, but just to more overtly connect the dots, Susan, is that when the County Board of Supervisors and ultimately the Coastal Commission took action on the dry cask storage facility, that action for the land use was in perpetuity. The licensing for the NRC has a regular interval, but that was both the application and the mitigation was based on a permanent facility.
Okay, and the other just last thing I kind of noted from public comment was the question about local monitoring of ocean water. And I just wondered if anyone wanted to speak to monitoring of ocean water that is done at Diablo Canyon.
I'm going to have to defer to Tom on that one in terms of what they're doing right now.
Yeah, I'll bring Trevor Rebel on, who deals with our affluent and our other monitoring programs, and that's also his scope in decommissioning. So, Trevor, you have the floor.
Sure, happy to have you. Very happy.
So you have probably two devices on that have the audio going through. Just one, please.
Right, happy to answer that. So ocean monitoring is ongoing part of our radiological effluent program. Currently, two portions of that. One is we monitor everything that goes out real time as it goes out. And the second part of that is what's called a REMP program, where there's ocean monitoring going on continuously at Diablo Canyon.
Thank you for filling us in on that. That was all I had. So if you want to go ahead, Chuck, with panel members, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Miriam. We have Kara has a question, and then Linda.
Thank you. First, Susan, thank you for your presentation. I really appreciate how easy it is for the public to find out when these public meetings are taking place. In fact, I went online and I Googled San Luis Obispo County Planning and Building. I went right to the site and I Googled even on my phone, and I was able to find the Diablo Canyon link. And I kept scrolling down, and at the bottom, it was very easy to add my name and get my name on the county email list. So anybody, pick up your phone, your computer, it's quite easy to stay informed, and I really encourage people to do that. And I wanted to respond to Susan Harvey's comment. In the past, PG&E has done other projects on Parcel P, and three good examples are the dry cask storage site for spent nuclear fuel, the simulator and training building on Parcel P, and also replacement of the steam generator. Those were all projects under CEQA, just like the decommissioning project is. They all required environmental impact reports, and at the end of that process, in order to get the permits necessary to complete those Parcel P projects, there was mitigation made. And those were mitigations in the form of 1,200 acres that were conserved and de-restricted at Point San Luis. It also created the Pecho Coast Trail. It also created the Bouchon Trail. And so there is ample precedent for projects on Parcel P to result in land conservation and public access. And this project, this EIR, is much larger than those that came before it. So I think it's very appropriate for the public to comment both during the scoping process as well as after the draft EIR is released to say that mitigation is appropriate and it's consistent with precedent on Diablo Canyon. And in my opinion, the entire 12,000 Diablo Canyon land acres should be conserved as mitigation for all the permits necessary to complete decommissioning. And I hope people will get involved who may agree with that and submit your comments along those lines. I would also just encourage the community of Avila Beach in particular to participate in this process. This community, more than any other, is going to be impacted at least by the trucks that will be going through town. So if you're living in Avila or know people that are or care about people, I really encourage you to get involved. And as Susan explained, and as I just tested out, it's very easy to go online and get your name on the list so you know when the meetings are occur, you know, when the deadlines come up, and you can get your comments in before the deadlines pass. Thank you.
Tom, I noticed that you raised your hand while Kara was talking. Did you have something to add regarding her question or comment?
I did. I appreciate her passion around that issue, but I would offer that the other five power plants that have been remediated through the CEQA process in California, the precedent I wouldn't suggest to you is from previous permits at Diablo Canyon, but rather like decommissioning activities. And those have not resulted in offsite mitigation as a condition of those permits. So that's the charge of the county to follow CEQA. And I'll invite Susan to maybe have a broader explanation of this, maybe in her wrap-up comments, about the rough proportionality and nexus. So that's a burden that the lead agency will weigh, and then ultimately the decision makers will have to ratify.
Thank you. Linda, you have a question or comment.
Yes. Thank you, Susan, for your presentation. I have two small questions. One is on the map. I noticed that the red area was parts of Parcel P that are planning to be kept. One of those was the substation, the electrical, that's what it's called, the substation with the big power lines. And it's my understanding that there may not be a company like a wind, an offshore wind company that is willing to buy those lines. And I'm wondering if that shouldn't be a tentative decision to whether to keep or to knock down, because if there's no use for those, then why on earth would we want them there? And maybe Tom can, you know. And also, I think it would be great to keep them there and use them. I'm not saying I don't want to, but I'm just saying that seems like it might be a possibility. And then the other thing was about the barge transport. Who will make the decision? Like when they cut, they're going to have to cut the reactor vessel into segments, and that is going to have to be transported out of Diablo. As earlier, when Jack Krasner was speaking, he was worried about the closeness of the proximity of the railroad substation to homes and a school. And So I'm thinking, like, who, number one, who makes the decision about whether the segmented reactor vessel could be taken out on a barge? Would that be the Coastal Commission or the county, or how is that environmental decision made? And two, who will make the decision about whether the segmented reactor vessel is going to be able to be in an area, you know, close to homes and a school? Thank you.
Tom, did you want to talk about the switch yard, and then I'll bring up the barging?
Yeah, good division. So, Linda, the switch yards and the transmission capacity functions independent of Diablo Canyon when we're not generating power. So those lines are useful to serving the customers of California for PG&E, and they will remain in place regardless of decommissioning and the decommissioning schedule. So they're staying. And then they do create opportunity for new power sources, both offshore, like the wind that Kara had mentioned earlier. And also, if you think about those routes, the two major routes go from Diablo Canyon, like the corner of a triangle, one in a northeasterly direction towards Fresno, and one in a due easterly direction towards Bakersfield. And so what you actually have is the opportunity for development along those hundreds of miles as well for new generation or energy storage projects. So they're a key backbone for the utility and for serving our 16 million customers. So they're going to remain in service. And again, they do create some ancillary opportunities when Diablo Canyon's capacity comes off those lines.
Okay, and then to answer your barging question, so there's a table in the project description where PG&E identifies the different waste types, time frame for transportation, and how they'll be transported. And it identifies reactor pressure vessel and the eternals. It will not be barged. It will go direct truck. So from the site directly to the waste to the disposal facility. So that answers that question. In terms of so we'll be evaluating based on what their proposal is in their application of what type of waste is transported where. But I do want to again point out that with regard to the Pismo Beach site, it's listed as a contingency, and PG&E has specifically stated that no radioactive waste, no hazardous waste will be transported to that location.
Oh, great. Thank you.
And Susan, if I could just add to the Pismo Yard, though, it is used in active utility role today. It supports our customers who are in transmission or vegetation management, and we have historically received shipments for Diablo Canyon. For instance, Linda, you might remember some low-pressure turbine replacement we did in the early 2000s. Those were delivered into that rail spur that we use. And ironically, the city of Pismo Beach has done emergency training on those rails with a simulated rail car. So it's active today for utility support.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there any further questions or comments with regard to the project application or the CEQA process? Great, so now it's time for a quick break before we go on to our next topic, which is strategic vision update. So let's take a break and come back together at 7:25. So let's take a quick break and we'll convene the meeting at 7:25.
rolling. Thank you. We are rolling and you are live.
All right. It is 7:26, so let's go ahead and reconvene the meeting. I hope everybody had a good quick break. The next item, major item on our agenda is a discussion of the engagement panel strategic plan and an update on the status of the recommendations. So I do want to remind all the participants and particularly the public attendees that there will be an opportunity for public comment again after two presentations. So hopefully we'll be able to answer any questions that you might have at that time also. So to kick this agenda item off, one of our panel members, Dina Bellman, is going to discuss sort of the origin and history of the strategic plan. Dina, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Chuck. Thanks, everyone, for being here with us tonight. The panel felt it was really important for us to share our perspective on the strategic vision and how that we are using that as a tool to provide a more deliberate look and at the strategic vision and the work that the panel has done. So I can't really see the PowerPoint. I don't know if they, there we go. Okay, let's go to the next one. The next slide, please. There we go. So the mission of the engagement panel, I think folks kind of get it, but the panel is intended to serve as a forum for the local community members to be offered key information related to the decommissioning process and provide direct input to PG&E and inform the regulatory agencies and other stakeholders on matters related to Diablo Canyon decommissioning. Next slide, please. As Miriam mentioned earlier, we are on our 20th meeting. So to date, the panel has held a total of 20 meetings and workshops. We anticipate meetings in 2022 to continue to provide essential information towards the decommissioning process. We're really looking forward to those topics and continuing this essential information. Next slide, please. Community involvement, that's what we're all about, right? So the statements and goals in the strategic vision are based on public input received by the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel from public meetings and workshops, from written correspondence and personal engagements by the panel members. The input was prepared by the panel using the facilitated process, which of course engages our wonderful facilitator, Chuck Anders. So if you look at the slide, you can see that we've had public comments on the about over 850 public comments on the different decommissioning topics, and an additional nearly 440 public comments just on our initial draft of the strategic vision document. So we really took a lot of those comments to heart when we pulled it all together and finally implemented it and released it in January of 2019. The panel deliberated on the best format to convey the community's input. What emerged was a strategic vision. And this vision is a living document, and it is on our website, so you can definitely dig into it. We have revised it and re-released it 4 different times, and we do submit those releases to the CPUC. Next slide. Let's just go there. So the structure of the strategic vision. Within the vision, there were statements and goals. So those really gave us a framework. And then the goals offered a description of the desired outcomes. So the panel felt that this should be documented as the priorities that we heard from the community, of course. In order to pursue those, the panel felt that this should take the form that those goals as an effort should take the form of a recommendation. So the recommendations that you see in there are the activities needed to meet those goals. Next slide, please. The strategic vision can be a lot to take in. We all have felt that over time. So the panel wanted to convey the outcomes and report out in an alternative format that would be more concise, yet continue to fulfill our mission and provide relevant information to the public and to all interested parties. The panel collaborated on a format that would more easily accomplish the goal of documenting progress by engaging representative analytics. So if you look in, oh, sorry, I didn't say next slide, did I? There you go. So those recommendations, if you can see, we've made 13 recommendations on the decommissioning process, 17 on the repurposing of facilities, 4 on our funding process, and 3 on our structure as a panel, then 14 on the Diablo Canyon lands, and 13 on the emergency planning process recommendations. Next slide, please. To carry on, we've made 23 recommendations on spent fuel management, 6 on the transportation of the low or no rate level radioactive waste materials. As I think Miriam mentioned, we'll be getting into that a little deeper in our next meeting that's in the first quarter of 2022. So we'll expect a lot more input and recommendations coming from that meeting. We also, to finish it up, we've had 16 recommendations about potential economic impacts and opportunities, and 16 also on water resources. So the panel has asked PG&E to share information on how these recommendations may have been implemented thus far. So we're really excited to hear their report out tonight. It's also important to recognize, as you have experienced in this meeting, the process of decommissioning Diablo Canyon falls upon a number of entities, PG&E, the county, state and federal regulatory agencies, and potentially any future owners of Diablo lands. So the recommendations are not solely for PG&E. They may also come to play into future processes. With that, I thank you for letting me do that report out for you, and I'll pass it over to Tom for our report out tonight.
Thanks, Dina. And I think we'll still have AGP or Chuck run the next video or the slides from PG&E.
Tom, are you going to run the slides or should we?
I just mentioned that you'll run them and I'll...
Okay.
I'll speak.
Bob, could you bring up slides? Just a moment. I'm having trouble. I'll get it in a minute. Appreciate everybody's patience with technology. Even though we've been doing this for a year and a half or more, we still seem to run into problems now and then.
All right, great. Thanks, AGP. Thanks, Chuck. So here's an update on some of the key items in the strategic vision and some of our next steps. You know, as a utility and feedback from the panel, we've got a lot going on, and we shared that in our earlier update. There's a milestone basically every month for the next several months, and a lot of those have been driven by the panel's input. And I would also say going backwards a month or two, with the successful completion of our application, that was fundamentally changed in some of our key project scope for things like barging that we'll get into in a minute. So the panels and the public input has helped us immensely. It's shaved years off the project, cost off the project, and it's helped reduce environmental impact. So we can go to the next slide, please. So we had this update today, but this is hot off the presses, right? We announced this at 3 p.m. today that the contracting strategy was determined, and that was consistent with the section of the engagement panel that's listed there on the third bullet. I will tell you that the strategic vision is a very robust document, and Dina did a good job of laying it out. So when possible, we try to show the citation. I will warn you, it uses Roman numerals and then an alphanumeric coding. So it's a robust document. It's well over 50 pages, but that's where that lines up. So So that was helpful in our deliberations about what contracting strategy to implore when we go ahead and, or employ when we go ahead and do the project. We'll go to the next slide, please. I will also tell you that some of these milestones then have a cascading effect. So for instance, when Dina showed those buckets of recommendations or those categories of recommendations, now that that contracting strategy has been identified, and if it's approved, then all those other labor type questions will cascade from that decision when final, right? So we have a categorization here, and this, we looked at the process and funding. What we talk about is at the top bullet here, we summarize the engagement panel's recommendations to the utility. And, you know, goal of completing work within 10 years, that's important. Our Humboldt Bay facility, for instance, we used a strategy of Safe Store, and we initiated that project in 2009. And I mentioned earlier, we're wrapping up here in 2021. So that project laid idle for well over 30 years and will be completed in its 40 some odd year. So that deep, that 10-year timeline is aggressive, actually, by industry standards. And the average, regardless of strategy, is longer than 10 years. So that's one of the things with the work on our pre-applications that we will obtain approvals on while we're still operating. We hope to take some of that time off to achieve that 10 years or sooner. These considerations that we look at when we receive something from the panel, what are the impacts to PG&E and external stakeholders? Does it have a regulatory path, and can the plans be changed? So we might get some recommendations that ask for X, and it's going to be X minus a little bit or X plus a little bit, right? So I do remind folks that when a lot of these recommendations came in and we were 7 to 8 years out from the project, as we get closer, that's one of the benefits of the panel process. The panel regularly updates that strategic vision and refines its recommendations as we both learn more, as the utility learns more, as regulations change, as the panel learns more. If we can go to the next slide, please. Future lands, this is by far the largest component of comments we've received. It categorizes into land stewardship, land transfer use, and some of the cultural heritage aspects. It's a very sensitive location, both ecologically and culturally, so it will need to be protected. The companies, I'm proud of the work the company has done out there, and we, the successor entity, will need to be able to match or exceed that type of management strategy. So again, we look at those considerations. You know, will they obtain or will they uphold the ecological, cultural, and scenic protection that we've offered? Will it do even better, we hope? Provision of public access, but it's going to be a delicate balance for that successor entity about how to do that. For instance, our northern trail at Point Bouchon had a rigorous cross-functional scientific research to achieve its carrying capacity, which is limited. And so it's not wide open like some parks or other areas to hike. And so that'll be a delicate balance in the future. And then, for instance, land use will need to be dependent on repurposing conclusions and also the project itself. We can't have anything that delays or upsets the project, right? So that at the end of the day, we still have this multi-decade, multi-billion dollar project to execute at Diablo Canyon. So we have to balance that with when the public would have access to the property, when a successor entity could take over. You heard Susan Strachan talk about 2039. Could there be a lease sooner, potentially? Could there be access and a circulation element that accommodates that sooner? Possibly. But again, it'll be a major industrial site for quite some time as it is today. Okay, next slide, please. The way we also try to balance these is we have a couple of processes, and Jim Welsh, our senior vice president of power generation, our chief nuclear officer, describes it this way, is that there have been different groups that have benefited and then helped support or have some of the burden of Diablo Canyon throughout its history. That's our customers. You know, they pay the ticket, right? They, through rates, they fund all the activities at Diablo Canyon that has benefited our community immensely. And then they benefit from that power production. Our shareholders have been at risk, and they've invested and they've supported that company or that facility in the company. And then our local community, right? We've had the jobs and the influx, but we have the burden of the emergency plan and siren tests and things like that. So when we look at future land use, repurposing, and the project overall, we try to balance those three needs. And we see the customer really championed by the Public Utilities Commission. That's one of their main focuses, is to look at what's equitable for all customers. I'll remind both the panel and those watching tonight that the PG&E service territory is immense. It's 48 of California's 58 counties, and we have around 16 million electric customers. So the PUC does balance local input with what's fair and equitable for those customers across that vast geographic area. So that's their charge is a little different. The County Board of Supervisors, we look at them as those that are executing the local community input. And our engagement panel, we see those are the two principal drivers for the local community. So that's how we receive that feedback. If we can go to the next slide, please. And this chart is a bit of an eye test. Excuse me. But what we show here, and this is filed with the Public Utilities Commission in June of 2020, this is how we do our engagement for ideas for future land use. And future land use both deals with the 12,000 acres and 14 miles of coastline and also parcel P. They're not exclusive through this process. We've tried to develop one process that takes into account a lot of different things for evaluation. And that includes the strategic vision, which is the third bullet down on that odd-shaped polygon on the right that feeds into the process. This diagram is at the Utilities Commission website, it's on the PG&E website, and it's on the engagement panel website. We're going to refine this a little bit in the 2021 filing, but it's mostly intact, and it served us well for how to screen items that might have come in. Go to the next slide, please. So we look at repurposing. We look at a couple of different areas. We look at existing facilities that are on land, and then the marine facilities, particularly the breakwater. And that's where the engagement panel's input has been really helpful for two things. One is our original lease and our current lease from the California State Lands Commission requires removal. And so it's not up to people that are not. Can we mute Eric Green? I don't know why he has a presentation here. But with that, we'll go ahead and evaluate that repurposing. And when the panel suggested that through some of its workshops, we actually had the State Lands Commission down to speak to the panel and the utility about that. So subsequent to that, there's actually been a white paper produced between the utility, the California State Lands Commission, the county, and others to describe how that could work. You can see a list of considerations down there. Is it consistent with future interests at the site? You know, we're going to be in the dry cast storage business for the foreseeable future, and we seek to be in the transmission business indefinitely. So those repurposing and public access things will need to be consistent with the utility uses that are on the land now. And then we've also had a couple of major policy changes since we started this. So the Public Utilities Commission has created a tribal lands rights program and policy that gives Indigenous peoples the first right of refusal when the land is to be sold. And also on our plan of reorganization and the bankruptcy resolution for the utility, the Public Utilities Commission picked up some jurisdiction over previously unregulated companies, Eureka Energy, for instance, that owns the land from the power plant to the front gate in Wild Cherry Canyon. Now, if it engages in any activity that results in a sale of asset of over $5 million, the Public Utilities Commission has a role in approving that as well now, too. That was not the case for the last 30 years. That's a new development within the last 9 months or so. Go to the next item. Next slide, please. So we just talked about the evaluation process. We have that large graph that was on the earlier slide. We have an internal team now that's starting to facilitate items that come in. We'll work with any curious party that has made inquiry to the utility to provide them information. We've redesigned our website to function as basically a free due diligence page. You can take a virtual tour of a building now. You can see its square footage. And then we've provided a breakdown of all of the parcels on the Diablo lands of its zoning and encumbrance. We've also gone to look at some real estate assessment, not appraisals. And JLL Real Estate Brokers completed that for us. And that was shared with the panel at its August meeting of this year. So if you're curious about how you combine how the world views the opportunity there from a real estate perspective, compatible with the zoning, that was an interesting discussion. There's nothing in the works now. And as Susan said, the county will evaluate that. But PG&E has no plans for further development outside of utility use that we must do. And that will be restricted to the upper elevations near the dry cast storage and our switch yards. And process. We want to make sure that anything that we're looking at doesn't block our path for free release criteria from the NRC. And that's key to any party that wants to take it over. Nobody is going to line up to buy that parcel until the NRC has deemed that it's been fully remediated. It's a very clean site, but nonetheless, that's a sort of endorsement when the project is complete that reduces liability, but it also gives assurance to any third party successor that the project has been done successfully. And they actually get to watch that process for free with some sort of due diligence, it's almost another due diligence process for a potential successor entity. It's almost the opposite of what happened at Fort Ord up in Monterey, where the university system took the parcel over before it was characterized. In this case, our characterization and our project will all be through a public process, and then the public has the right to view and comment that, and then independent regulators will have to approve that the mitigation's been successful. Go to the next slide, please. So we heard from Linda earlier about some of the facilities. So in the lower left portion of this facility, this is an aerial view looking north to south. You can see there's two salmon patches, two little squares or rectangles. Those are the switch yards that we were discussing. And the larger one on the left, the 500 kV, that's 500,000 volts. That's the one I described that runs to both the Bakersfield and Fresno area. And then that switch yard down below, where it says 230 kV in the lower third there, that's the one that is targeted for potential support for offshore wind in addition to the 500 kV. And that will also support Diablo Canyon, because while we've been at this point a power generation station for 36 years, we'll become a retail customer for electricity. So that's how we'll bring in the power to supply energy to the site to conduct the decommissioning. We can go to the next slide, please. That foreshadowed, I mentioned the breakwater earlier, this slide's a little tight, but what the image on the right is conveying is the enormity of the breakwater. So in the middle third column, you can see something called a tri-bar. It looks like a jack, like the children's toy. And you can see a silhouette of a 6-foot man standing next to the jacks. They're 37 tons each. There's over 4,000 of them, and they encapsulate a pile of riprap that is up to 60 feet deep. So at the mouth of our harbor, it's 60 feet deep because we're on the end of the continental shelf, and in our intake structure, where we'll convert that from where we run water through the power plant to a barging facility, we're over 30 feet deep. When you look at the mass on this diagram, what it's showing you is the charcoal gray center of those things that look like tadpoles, that's the mass you see above the waterline. The dark blue area is its footprint on the ocean floor, and it's immense. It's almost 7 acres. It's 6.9 acres. It's over 700,000 tons, and it would result in another 32,000 trucks if we didn't have that facility, if we removed that facility. Said another way, it's more material than the entire nuclear power plant complex. So we have this binary choice. We repurpose it or we remove it and send it out of state. So we're hopeful to be successful in creating California's next newest public harbor. Next slide, please. So the panel made a series of emergency planning and transportation waste recommendations as well. Emergency plans to be prepared for the entire decommissioning process and future use of the lands and during waste transportation. You'll see some of those as conditions of permits as the project moves forward. And the emergency plan is chiefly governed by licensing requirements for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We've already had some public meetings and filed a license amendment for what that'll look like in the future once we're starting or once we're no longer generating power. Next slide, please. So here's some of the evaluation process. There's actually going to be three periods of emergency planning transition. So as you're operating the power plant for about that first 16 months after you shut down, there's a risk profile and you have certain emergency mitigations and staffing. Then the conditions change and it drops. You change your staffing again. That'll be a second license period. And then once all of the spent nuclear fuel is loaded up in the dry cask facility, it's called an ISFC-only emergency plan, and our planning will change again. However, because of that joint proposal that we talked about earlier from 2016 and our recent approval from the Public Utilities Commission for our 2018 cost triennial proceeding, the funding to keep the county whole for its emergency planning, despite a change in risk profile, is there as long as we have a Part 50 license. what that really means is the County of San Luis Obispo will receive funding from PG&E for about 4.5 full-time emergency planners. Comparable counties will have one for that size of population. So that the county will continue and its citizens will continue to enjoy a really robust emergency plan that's actually all hazards and far beyond nuclear. It includes tsunami planning, evacuation routes, well and fire, et cetera. So we'll be really well served from that for decades to come. We can go to the next slide, please. Spent fuel management, that's been a big discussion amongst the panel, and I think that Dean also teed up that that'll be our next meeting, the first of the year. We'll have an update on the new system that will house the fuel that's remaining or yet to be on site, right? We're still generating power for 4 years, so we have fuel in each spent fuel pool, and we'll still bring new fuel on site for the remaining operations of the plant. All of our fuel will fit on that ISFACI pad, that dry cask facility. It's about the size of a football field. And so we'll have all the fuel up on the hill by 2029. A number of our recommendations and requirements in our request for proposal for the new system were pushed to us from the California Energy Commission and this engagement panel. Additionally, when the panel had a number of questions, we're looking for an independent voice. PG&E commissioned a risk study with the B. John Garrick Institute of Risk Studies at UCLA and issued a public report about some different strategies and the risk profiles that will help inform our decisions as we move ahead. And again, that announcement will be in the first quarter of 2021. Next slide, please. So dry cask storage, here's the citations, spent fuel, dry cask, be loaded within 4 years after shutdown. The ultimate goal is to have the spent fuel pools empty as soon as possible. That's listed in the strategic vision, and it looks like we're going to be able to obtain that in 4 years. We have numerous bidders competing in that request for proposal, and all have given us a viable technical and regulatory path to achieve that. So that's a momentous achievement. And again, the panel and our partners in the joint proposal really helped push for that. To give it some context, our current technical specification on the dry cask system we use today, it would take 13 years to do that. So that takes 9 years off the project alone. So you think about repurposing, public access, cost, and having everything up at that independent facility, that's a major, major achievement. Next slide, please. So on that request for proposal process, here's where we are. So that first column on the left shows that public input period for longer, about 2 years or more. That included multiple discussions with the engagement panel. We've been collaborating with the California Energy Commission, and they had a non-disclosure agreement so that they could review proprietary information from the vendors and help inform both the risk study from UCLA and our request for proposal. And then we had the 2018 Public Utilities Commission proceeding that also had interveners that pushed in requirements and goals for fuel management. So those were all put into that request for proposal. That's that center column where you see the red arrow. We are here. So we've had additional Energy Commission support throughout that process, and we expect to award that contract maybe in the last week of December to the first couple weeks of January. And then that'll launch a new public process, right? That new system will be different from the current system, so there will be some regulatory proceedings with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we expect to obtain that by 2025. That gives us several years for fabrication and then to begin loading in that 2028-2029 period to have the pools empty in that four-year period. So that will launch yet another public process. We can go to the next slide, please. So lots of impact, lots of discussion on the economics and economic impact. The utility has worked well with others on that process. Started with a joint proposal, again, with some significant funding for mitigation to the local community. And then we've heard questions earlier today from David Baldwin and Kara Woodruff and others about the local workforce and decommissioning activities. So now that we've announced that hybrid strategy, a lot of these items will cascade from that. So we'll be looking for help with that, frankly, in that NDTCP proceeding. And we think other stakeholders will probably join that filing to at least uphold that portion of the filing. Go to the next slide, please. So this is a long view of the coastal development process, and it just shows where we are now. Susan's slide was a little simpler, and I appreciate it more and more each time I see hers. This shows our work running up to the application process and where that we are here arrow is. You'll see the green circle down below talks about that public scoping meeting and then that draft environmental impact report. When the county works on that, we'll be making a parallel application to the California Coastal Commission. We didn't talk about it a lot tonight, but everything from the median high tide line out is the exclusive or called original jurisdiction of the Coastal Commission. So if you think about our discharge structure, our breakwater, and where we touch the coastal resource from the median high tide line out, that'll be in that application. And then that's the upper path. The middle path is the main line through the lead CEQA agency, which is the county. And then we assume the possibility of appeal and that those two processes can merge together at the Coastal Commission for its ultimate adoption. So that's what we're trying to show. There is a potential for a two-track path. Next slide, please. And in that application, there were a number of items from the engagement panel. Retention of the switchyards for support of future renewable power, green energy. You see numerous recommendations there. The second check from the bottom. I've already talked about the breakwater numerous times. It's such an impactful thing that has the ability to save our customers over $400 million by the time of removal. So it's a major, major component to the decommissioning. And then the other one that we announced today, you know, or we've announced previously, our intention is to go directly into decommissioning and take full advantage of this 9-year planning horizon and avoid something called safe store, which was actually a strategy we used at Humboldt Bay. And that's simply when you mothball a power plant, you might move the fuel to dry cast storage and then you wait. The NRC regulations provide 60 years for you to complete the decommissioning project. And we intend to use a small fraction of that time. Go to the next slide, please. Additional recommendations from the panel that are in there, including minimizing waste, repurposing. We don't do enough of it in this slide, but I think we have a larger slide to talk about that barging and avoid those impacts to peak traffic times. So for instance, you know, the power plant operates 24/7, 365. So we go to work on Friday when people are going to the beach. But in decommissioning, one of the key aspects that's very different from now is we'll work 4/10 Monday through Thursday, and we go to work long before anyone's going to the beach. So the traffic impacts and the way that that traffic study will lay out will be nice. It matches how the public uses Avila Beach and that we're not trying to use the roadways at the same time. Let's go to the next slide, please. So here's an example of the barge and what we were looking at. So to me, the middle check is the big check from a community impact standpoint. It reduces about 95% of the truck trips for the first 15 years, and it reduces emissions as well. What you see on the left bottom is something called an intermodal. It's like a C train, but a little bit smaller. They can hold up to 25 tons of material, and there's a secondary advantage to that. In California, the roadways are typically limited to a 20-ton capacity for a truck. But the other neighboring states actually regulate at 25 tons. If you do simple math, it can eliminate 25% of the truck trips outside of California or through California when we get on a barge. So you take the barge to a port, you get it on a rail, and then it gets onto a truck. That'll be 25% fewer trucks on the back end of that transportation cycle. And then lastly, the reduction of transportation risk and exposure by mile is significant. It's over 73%, or it is 73%. And that was also looked at from the UCLA Risk Institute. So that's a public report on the engagement panel's website as well. But this, again, was a real strong push from our engagement panel. This was not in the scope of the project when we originally submitted and designed the project in 2018. So that's been a huge impact. And thanks again for the help on that. And that looks like that's going to come to fruition. That's going to be a strong component of our application process. Next slide, please. Other considerations in the permit application? We've got a lot in there. We look at that breakwater and how it's also functioning as a reef right now. We want to eliminate that amount of demolition debris. So for instance, the project contemplates using clean concrete on site and rubblizing that and blending it with other materials from previously disturbed locations for backfill in some of the excavations when we remove large structures. So that gets rid of significant cost and doesn't clog landfills with clean concrete when we can do that with a blended approach. It's been done several times in the county, and I think it's a really good concept to pursue. Go to the next slide, please. Water resources. There's been a lot of concern about water in a couple of different ways. Not only the water quality, which is really nice out there, right? There's not a lot of discharge. There's miles and miles without any other water user other than the power plant. And so you have the retention of the breakwaters in the marina that keeps that intertidal zone in its current status. There's also been consideration and a lot of interest in a successor entity for the desalinization facility. It's very important to some of our panel members. The utility intends to run the desalination facility through 2035 today, and we're actually we're retrofitting it right now and recapitalizing that to make sure that it's good for the next 15, 16 years. So we have a fair amount of time to find someone if they wish to connect it to the community. It is quite a ways from the community, right? Diablo Canyon is essentially an island, and it's about a 7-mile run to the south and about 11-mile run to the north to connect it to municipal supplies. But again, under contract to 2035, I do always like to point out PG&E owns the pipes up to it and the pipes out from it and the reservoirs, but that box in the middle is run by our partners at Suez. We're not in the, that's not our day job making desalinated water, so we contract with Suez for that. Go to the next slide, please. So our next steps, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but we've got a lot coming, so we can go to the next slide. We'll file the NDTCP in December. Again, that's an update on the budget. That's, we get further refinement. We update cost projections and other strategic decisions like the contracting strategy and that filing before the Public Utilities Commission. That typically takes about 18 months. There are other interveners, parties join. We've had, in, for instance, TURN, the Utility Reform Network, the County of San Luis Obispo, the Mothers for Peace and the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, among others. They come in. They evaluate our case. They can offer testimony that we should do something different. We are either have a path for reaching a settlement, as we did in our last rate case, where the parties come together and hammer out a consensus-based document that the Utilities Commission can approve, or it goes a litigation route. And these are essentially run as trials where the administrative law judge will ultimately make a recommendation and the Public Utilities Commission will have a hearing to approve it. So we also include the strategic visions from the panel as part of that filing. So it's a part of the official record of the proceeding before the Utilities Commission. With that, NDTCP and the fuel RFP being announced in the Q1, we're going to give the panel an update on all of its 124 recommendations and status them all. Again, not all of them, as Dina said, were directly to PG&E. Some of them were encouraging PG&E to work with others, and some of them were to regulators. So we'll be obtaining all of those updates. And once all that information becomes public with those two filings and the announcement of the RFP, will have a significant update to this panel. But again, you look at the bottom line here with these check marks on here, you know, the panel has driven huge public interest. Dina talked about it, and that was really over 1,000 public comments that were formal. That doesn't include the public comments at our workshops, the comments tonight, when members of the panel of the utility go out and speak to, say, a Rotary Club. So it's really driven the conversation in a strong way. And I'd also point to you that if we didn't have the engagement panel, the first local discussions we'd be having about this project that we started in 2018 in May would be coming up this year with the panel's scoping meeting, or excuse me, with the county's scoping meetings. So we've already had a 3-year dialogue and 20 public meetings before we have our first regulatory driven meeting on this project. So that's an inordinate amount of work and unmatched any project I've been involved in. And like I had mentioned, it reshaped our thinking and created new project scope, the things we weren't thinking about, like barging, the risk studies, the RFP and regulatory applications. And that's going to result in reduced impacts to the environment, cost savings, and get the project done much quicker. So it's a major aid into the project. And the panel itself will be a topic of the 2021 NDTCP and its efficacy. How effective is it in helping shape the project to benefit all of PG&E's customers, not just the local community? And I think what we can agree on is that the case is pretty simple to make that it's had a major impact. So I think that concludes this presentation. We can go to the next slide. And I'll be happy to take any questions or suggestions from the panel. And I know we're also going to go to public comment. So if there's any clarification the panel would like, I'd be happy to do that right now. Otherwise, we can go to public comment.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions of the panel before we open it up for public comment? Great. Now's another opportunity for the members.
I do believe Kara has her hand up.
Oh, Kara, I didn't see your hand. Go ahead.
Sorry, briefly. Tom, I had a question for you about barging. When PG&E replaced the steam generator, I believe you used a barge. And I'm wondering, when we're talking about barging all the decommissioning debris, do you have to change the infrastructure either on the land or on the marina? Or is it just, can you use what you have right now? What does the future look like for that?
So thanks, Kara. So what we're going to do is change and improve the barging infrastructure because of the vast volume. So when we brought in the steam generators, it was 8 parts. And so it was 8 things to get off a barge, right? Those barges essentially had a gangplank, and they came in to the eastern edge of our breakwater in our marina where our boat docks are now. And just to the south of those boat docks, they made landing. And we laid down some sand to make some leveling. The gangplank was dropped, and those 8 parts came off, 2 at a time, 4 barges in total. But because of the volume, you know, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of containers and crane work, what we seek to do is that our intake structure, that gray concrete area that's about 200 feet long in the water, where we take in the water, we're going to modify the top of that. I call it flat decking it. We're going to pour it flat with concrete, put a crane up there, and our barges will moor there. So they'll tie up to that infrastructure. The fendering is really simple. The interface between that concrete structure and the barges, it's giant tractor tires. So we went all around the Port of San Diego, Long Beach, and Los Angeles and met with barge operators and those ports. And that conversion is really simple. We've also met with those barge operators, and they really like that infrastructure and idea. So that's using the current structure, that big monolithic concrete, and just changing that top surface is how we're going to load those barges. And then we have a straight shot out to the Pacific, and the barges can go to the ports that will ultimately have the contracts.
So is that project something that would be included in the EIR process for the county, or is that more under the jurisdiction of original jurisdiction by the Coastal Commission?
Yes. So it's in the environmental impact report. It's in the project description, and it will have application through both entities. So the county, the State Lands Commission, and Coastal Commission have also worked together so that this environmental impact report, that one environmental document, will serve all 3 processes. So that's the analysis that the county is leading with input from those agencies and Aspen Environmental.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Scott, you've got your hand up, but before you ask your question, I'd like to remind the public attendees to raise your hand if you would like to make a comment or ask a question on this topic. So anyone from the public who would like to ask a question, make a comment, raise your hand, and we'll convene that public comment process right after Scott's question.
I'm in line since I don't have a hand. Eric is in line after Scott, or whenever other members of the public.
We hear you, Mr. Greening. All right, Mr. Lathrop.
Tom, I was just curious to hear this evening about the Eureka property having some consideration or review by the CPUC. Are you saying that the Eureka property will go through the 851 process or some other process?
I would describe it as 851-like. We haven't had it yet, and this was a result of the resolution to our bankruptcy to get the state to agree to how it was going to be executed. So there was an expansion of Public Utilities Commission authority with that settlement, right? So that's the bottom line. That threshold is the same threshold for the 851 process when it's a full commission action. Those amounts below, when it's utility encumbered funds, it's an advice letter. With the plan of reorganization, it's silent. So they don't have jurisdiction unless we hit that $5 million threshold on an unregulated affiliate. So now I'd say quasi-regulated affiliate, right?
Understood. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's go to provide the opportunity for public comment from the panel members, and I'd remind you, or from the public, I'd remind you to state your name, your residence, and any affiliation you might have. So the first and right now the only hand that we have up is Lauren Brown. Lauren? Go ahead, Lauren.
All right, I just unmuted. Well, listen, as a former member of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel, I took particular pleasure in listening to Tom Jones's report on how PG&E has incorporated guidance from the panel into their planning. It's extensive. And for me, it's very gratifying to see that. I'd like to assert the following point. These positions from the panel didn't just come from the minds of the panel members. It was a result of an extensive engagement with the public, of conducting multiple public hearings, taking input from the public, and incorporating that into the thinking about our recommendations. And I would just like to encourage the public to continue that process. We're a long way from finishing this. And also to compliment PG&E for creating the process in the first place and really paying attention. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Lauren. One more.
Thank you.
That is Susan Harvey.
Actually, Susan? Eric Greening had his, you know, he doesn't have his hand to raise.
I don't have a hand. Either way, whoever is next.
Susan next, and then Eric. Eric somehow snuck in as a panelist, so I don't see him when I'm looking at attendees' hands, so.
I'm sorry, that's because Eric is, with his equipment, he's not able to stay on the attendee side and still be heard.
Okay, that's good. But Susan and then Eric.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. So Susan Harvey, I'm in the county near Paso Robles, and I'm commenting on behalf of the San Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club. And I have a couple of questions. When you refer to the intermodal containers, I'm wondering if they'll be sealed and waterproof and watertight while they're being transported. And then my next question is the permitting for the use of the port for barging, will that permit be exclusively for and by decommissioning through 2039? In other words, will that be the only activity that is being permitted at that port site until 2039?
Yeah, so your first question, the simple answer, yes, they're watertight, they're sealed.
Okay, thank you.
Robust shipping containers. The second question is, will that be the only activity? No, we currently run boats out of there for our marine monitoring program. And then prior to 9/11, it was a harbor of safe refuge. And so it was common to see three or four, maybe five fishing vessels just come in our harbor and take anchorage during the night or in the morning and then go back out and start fishing again. So that use could occur independent of this activity. What we're trying to do is part of our environmental impact report bounds the impacts from that process, including the shipping and transportation. Secondarily, because we would be conducting some construction in the original jurisdiction area, that will be subject to the California Coastal Commission to approve that modification, as it will also be part of a new lease with the California State Lands Commission. So again, the county leading the environmental impact report, that document is going to serve all three of those processes. So the county has the lead in the analysis and coordinates with those other agencies about what level of detail they'll require. So to take that one step further, when we make our application for the lease with California State Lands Commission, there's different levels of engineering diagrams and design, and we'll be at what's called the 30% level. So we'll have more than a conceptual design of how that structure will be modified to accommodate barging transportation. Now, if you think repurposing and succession, anything that can launch a, you know, that can successfully convey a 25-ton container onto a barge 100 feet out can certainly launch any recreational vessel into the water. So the opportunities there will be beyond what's in the application.
Thank you, Susan. Did that answer your questions?
Thanks, I guess. I think I'm not quite sure what all my questions are, but thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for asking. Eric Greening, go ahead, please.
Thank you. And first, I'd like to second Scott Lathrop's comments. Thanks to the commission for hearing and taking in all of the public comment, and to PG&E for making an effort to take a lot of those recommendations and find ways to implement them. I do have two questions. One relative to the approval process on the casks by the NRC. There is a public comment period in that process. And my question on that is simply, what consequence those public comments have? Can they actually lead to to changes in the project description, to mitigation measures? And then my second question, and I want to be sure that Susan is on the same page with Tom with this. We saw what looked to me to be a very rushed schedule for approval. If both the Planning Commission and the supervisors are to approve this project by the end of 2022, there's normally at least 2 months between a Planning Commission action and a supervisor's appeal hearing. So that would be Planning Commission in October. That's 11 months from now. That presumes a completed final EIR with a 60-day comment period between the draft and the final. That simply looks like an extremely rushed EIR process, considering all that it has to look at. That would basically put a draft EIR out in June, 6 months after the scoping period is done. I would assert that what we most need from the EIR process is not speed, but thoroughness. And I don't see how a schedule that presupposes a completed EIR, final EIR by October, can accommodate the needed thoroughness. So, Tom, I don't want to put Susan on the spot. I know this isn't her segment, but I would like to know that Tom and Susan are on the same page with this. Thank you.
We're on the same chapter. I don't know we're on the same page, Eric. And I tell you that I think Susan was clear in her update earlier that the county intends to publish its schedule for this process that's been revised around the scoping period. So I would say stay tuned for a couple of weeks and that we'll hear more from the county on that schedule. Our schedule doesn't change, though, and it assumes a pessimistic hearing. We did build it off of our previous paths through the county and coastal process, Eric. And at the end of the day, we still look for that final approval 3 years from now at the California Coastal Commission. And that's actually a longer schedule than our other projects have had. To your first question, I really think there was a conflating or a combination of a couple different processes. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will have a licensing action on the safety of the casks. It's federally preempted. That'll be their exclusive jurisdiction. That process will be a licensing action, but the land use and CEQA process for the construction of dry cask storage was for the entire project for the loading of up to 138 casks for fuel at that site and all seven pads in perpetuity. So that action before the County Board of Supervisors and Coastal Commission won't come back. So for the future of dry cask storage, it's a licensing action. Then to your last point, does the NRC take public comment into account? Yes, they do. And there's multiple ways. One, there's just straight public comment, like people do at a hearing or a meeting like this. And the second is they also have their own intervention process where people can achieve standing and participate in the licensing action. So all of those things are run by the NRC, not the utility. I'm just familiar with them, but that's laid out on the NRC's website as well.
Thank you for clarifying that. And again, I will continue to advocate for thoroughness over speed when it comes to environmental review. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Susan, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I don't. I'd rather keep the schedule surprised to the scoping meetings.
Great. Thank you. Any other public members with, that would like to make a comment, raise your hand. I don't see any. If not, let's go on to panel questions and so on. And Kara, you have a question.
No, I forgot to turn down my hand.
Any other panelists have a question of Tom with regard to the strategic plan and the status report? Great. Well, that concludes our major topics. Linda Seeley is going to tell us about the upcoming panel meeting in the first quarter of 2022. So, Linda, the floor is yours. And I think, Zeke, we need a slide presentation also. Thank you. Go ahead, Linda. Linda, I think you're muted. Welcome to my world.
Thank you. Our panel is going to have a meeting in, we haven't scheduled it yet, but we're thinking probably the early part of March to look at the by that time, PG&E will have revealed which dry cask storage system that they have picked. And we're going to have a panel meeting to introduce the public to that and to take comments from the public. And it will be a very important meeting. I wanted to talk tonight a little bit about our Tom, I appreciated your showing us how you've incorporated the panel's recommendations into your RFP. But there are certain, I wanted to alert the panel and the public to parts of our recommendations that we still are holding dear and that we think are very important. So if I could get I'm operating from our recommendations in the strategic vision. Can you go to the next slide, please? Okay. We had a weekend of meetings in 2019 about our recommendations for, about spent fuel storage in the dry casks. And we had and after that we met and we spent a lot of time on this and we incorporated these recommendations into the strategic vision. You see, we recommended that they begin the RFP process. That was postponed for a while, but it's done. And that they thoroughly investigate and research all potential dry cask storage systems in order to determine the very best site-specific system, because we're on, the seismic land, the seismically active land, and we do not know how long those casks are going to be there. But I want to skip, and we recommended that they use a very updated system. And D is the one I wanted to really emphasize. We talked about this and considered it very much, that we recommended a dry cask storage system that would allow for 24-hour radiation monitoring, full inspection capability, that it could be fully retrievable in case there were a crack or a problem with one of them, have the capability to either repackage or repair a damaged cask, and that the new casks should be licensed for transportation. And of course, that the new dry cask system minimize the dose rates to the workers. The recommendations in number D are very important. Okay, next slide. The aging management program is already in process, and one of our recommendations that PG&E, I think, is not going to take under consideration is that they conduct a future feasibility assessment of the benefits and costs of enclosing the existing ISFSI. I think I understood from Tom that is physically impossible for the way the casks are laid out right now. And we are recommending that if stress corrosion cracks or other degradation is found, it should be identified early and appropriate corrective actions must be taken immediately. And it could include enclosing the ISFSI in a structure, and that PG&E share the data with the regulators, of course, and the community. And we recommended the PG&E continue to participate in research and collect data on the potential degradation of canisters. Those canisters that are sitting at Diablo Canyon on the ISFSI are subject, because of the climate, because of all the of salt in the atmosphere and the moisture, they're really put under stressful conditions. And when we think about that they may be there for a very long time, they have to be really tended to. And then we also recommended that PG&E have an on-site facility or another means in place to deal with potential leaks from spent fuel canisters and the ability to repackage the spent fuel if necessary. This is a big ask, but it's an important ask. And we don't know, because the spent fuel canisters have only been used for, I think the maximum is about 20 years around the world. There isn't a whole lot of data about them. So I guess that our recommendations really are for PG&E to stay on its toes, to monitor that, because if there is a leak, if we do have a problem, it negates all of our other plans for repurposing, et cetera. Next slide. Oh, is that the last? No. Oh, and then we recommended that PG&E continue to own Diablo Canyon and manage the decommissioning process. And they've told us tonight that they will continue to own it, but they will use the hybrid process for decommissioning, which really makes sense. Anyway, that's about all I have to say. I hope that the public will get the date set soon, and we'll make an announcement so that people can get ready for this meeting. It's going to be very important. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Linda. I'd like to just open it up to any of the panel members if they have any final comments or thoughts. Miriam, did we catch all of the public comments, questions, and answers?
Yes, I think we did, and I really appreciate the engagement and the respectful participation from the public and the staff just being so on top of things. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments before we adjourn?
One from the public.
Go ahead, Eric.
Thank you. I just wanted to get some clarification. I thought I heard that the panel was going to have a field trip to San Onofre. Is that correct? Where you'll physically actually be touring the facilities there. And my question is that going to be a public meeting in any way, either that we would be able to be present virtually or that people would be present on the site physically? And again, I have the concern that being on a tour only with the utility operator gives you certainly a large part of the picture, but you don't have a complete picture unless the public is also able to participate and speak to you. And particularly, I would assume people in the Samuel Lawrence Foundation would be very interested in participating and having their concerns heard. It might provide some lessons for us in terms of things to avoid. So tell if you can explain more about the circumstances of the meeting and its openness to the public, and whether the proceedings of that meeting will somehow be available to the public after it has happened. Thank you.
Yeah, Chuck, I can address that. This is Tom Jones. So, no, it is not open to the public. It's a intense tour of the physical decommissioning of the power plant. So everyone will be wearing personal protective equipment. They'll be escorted by experts from Southern California Edison in a pretty hazardous industrial environment. So it's not going to be a public meeting, and it is by invitation to their private property. I will say that the panel will clearly give an update, and they do trip reports. So the panel has benchmarked San Onofre. It's traveled to Rancho Seco in the past and offered those updates to the public for what they've seen. As with regard to any entity, whether it's Samuel Lawrence or anyone else, the panel's free to invite whom they wish when we build out an agenda for a meeting.
Thank you. And so I will repeat the comment from earlier in the meeting that I think that the Samuel Lawrence Foundation should be invited to a future meeting, one of your regular public meetings, as well as the utility itself, to kind of give their perspective as well as the utility's perspective on lessons that we can take with us in terms of our own experience that is happening in ensuing years that they've been through already. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric, and appreciate your comments. And the panel can choose to invite anyone to their panel meetings and solicit their perspectives. With that, I would like to adjourn the meeting. I want to remind everyone that video of this meeting will be posted on the panel website and be available. We'll also have the presentations that were made posted on the website and other support materials. The public can also add comments on the panel website by simply going to the site and clicking on submit comment and submit comments that perhaps you didn't think of during the meeting. So please continue to participate and stay engaged. Looks like our next public meeting will be the beginning of next year. So on behalf of the panel, I would like to wish everyone a safe and happy holidays. Hope you have a good evening, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.